Okay, welcome everybody. Our guest artist this evening is Jim Lehman, and I think he's going to be doing a Rachmaninoff concerto. And no, I think probably everybody in the room knows Jim, but I'll do the honors of an introduction anyway. There may be things about him you don't know. Jim has been here at EMU since 2006. He finished up his doctorate at University of Pittsburgh in 2009 in public and international affairs, and he teaches courses in the business department in management, finance, organization, and leadership studies. He's also got a lot of international experience, worked for 12 years in Kenya with an NGO, and brings a lot of that knowledge and experience to his classes. Currently, he's chairing the department and doing a great job of that. I think many of you actually know Jim as a really articulate voice in the university for sustainability, and also someone who's a role model in how to put that into practice. And that's what he's going to be talking to us about today. So welcome, Jim.
Thank you, Fred. And I'm impressed that on one of our first warm, sunny afternoons of the year, you chose to come indoors. So I hope to give you a little sunshine in terms of the benefits of solar energy. A couple of acknowledgments I'd like to make here before I get started. I've had a lot of help along the way. This is the result of a sabbatical and research project. And so I'd like to give thanks to Fred, administration, and the Faculty Status Committee for their work in supporting sabbaticals. It was really that process, and my first, that made me realize that I've got to have some distance from the day-to-day hustle and bustle of life on campus to get serious work done on research and writing. Also, I had some students work with me through 2 years. 2016 graduates Katie Miller and Lauren Souter and Aaron Yoder helped in terms of doing some early research and design in the spring of 2016. And current senior Aaron Dunmore was a research assistant last spring. Also, I'd like to introduce my partners in this project, Charles Hendricks. Let me ask you to stand so others can see who you are. Charles is a local architect, works for the Gaines Group, and brought that perspective to this project. And Eric Beck, please stand. Eric is a builder, home builder, and now solar installer since our project. His businesses are Beck Builders and Green Hill Solar. So the three of us began talking about this topic a number of years ago. And first it was broadly, how can we solve the problems of climate change as it relates to how we live? And not only practices, but the kind of buildings we live in and the systems that we operate. And so there was a time when my family was looking to build a new house, and that was coinciding with my sabbatical, which enabled a bit of time for research. And so I invited the two of them to partner with me on both of those projects. And the idea was that we would use this case study, designing and building what we hoped would be a climate neutral home, as a way to inform the choices that go into everything, you know, from the building envelope to the energy systems to how you heat and cool the building. So that was our goal. The goal of our house was for it to be climate neutral in operations, including powering our local transportation by having enough renewable generation of energy on site to power electric vehicle. Now, ours wouldn't be the first sustainable home. There are others around the country, around the world, a couple here in the community that are, let's say, climate neutral or carbon neutral. But in our research, we didn't find really good resources, kind of a clear path to take to achieve this goal. And Charles is known in this area as the architect with environmental sensitivities, and Eric has been building sensible and environmentally sensitive buildings for many years as well. So let's move on here, and I'll show you the outline of where we're headed today. I'll let you read that on your own. The three spheres in the upper right-hand corner are used in many contexts. That emblem of the three interlocking rings is one that we use as the logo of business programs here at EMU, and that's to represent people, planet, and profits. And that's thinking about the holistic view of business and the way that business can be used to promote the common good. So in the case of sustainable housing, we wanted to explore the overlapping areas of these three circle areas. That's the dark orange wedge in the middle. Environmentally, we wanted to reduce, eliminate, or offset environmental impact. Economically, it needed to be within reach, reasonable paybacks, it needed to be affordable. And socially, we hoped it would be livable, not too much outside of common standards. So nearly all homes in the U.S. today are built in the overlapping section of social and economic, the pink wedge in that graphic. They're affordable. That's one of the primary metrics that drives choices in the home building market. And people want them to be livable. So most of the time today, we'll be reviewing our findings, which we found to be very surprising. And note that at the end, we hope to have time for your comments and questions. So let's start with the problem. Humanity is in an ecological overshoot position with regard to our natural sinks, our natural resources, both in terms of finite and regenerative resources. And this has both health and justice implications. And climate change is particularly worrisome. And while those challenges are global, we need to act locally. Particularly Americans, I think, need to take responsibility for their actions. We represent 4% of the global population. We emit, in terms of greenhouse gases, far more than that percentage. But it's interesting when you look back in time, since the Industrial Revolution, 25%, a quarter of the greenhouse gas emissions that have been anthropogenically released into the atmosphere have come from the U.S. So we need to begin working at this and taking responsibility. These pie charts on the slide help focus on the importance of our study. They show energy consumption and CO2 emissions by sector. And on both, you can see that buildings account for about half of energy and CO2 emissions. And if you add transportation, we're talking about 75% of the carbon footprint of the average American family, perhaps, or home. So remember that our objective on the case home was to make it climate neutral, both in terms of accounting for building operations and transportation. We also wanted to produce enough energy to push back into the grid to offset what's called embodied energy. That is the energy that went into building the home. And this is depicted in the small yellow wedge on the upper graph. That's labeled building construction and materials. And there's often this interesting trade-off between the embodied energy of choices in the home building process and operational benefits that may come from that embodied energy. So we found that there were gaps in the research, in the literature, in the building industry that we wanted to fill. Charles and Eric, I think, were also very keen on having a resource that would document this that they could hand to potential clients, hopefully to convince more people to take up choices that would lead to a more sustainable future. The case study was important for me because as I looked at the research, I saw a lot of, let's say, lab-based experiments and theoretical benefits that were purported, but this case would enable us to test ideas and to monitor data, monitor actual information. It would also provide us with probably the best case we had of a side-by-side comparison. This is one of the challenges in the home building or environmental housing movement, is that you can't put the same group of people with the same energy habits and patterns in one house and then take them to another one that's exactly the same, but with a different set of parameters. So the case house would allow us to test that out. Here are some of the assumptions in the building industry that are firmly entrenched. Solar PV, that is the active photovoltaic systems, are thought of as a nice environmental choice, but it's not economically viable. If it were, then we'd see it going up on every house. Every new house would be designed for and would include solar PV. So if we can't generate our own renewable energy in an economically viable way, then we should try and reduce energy losses. And I reference here the negawatt movement, the idea that the best watt is not the one that's demanded and cleaned up, but is not demanded in the first place. And reducing heat loss means bolstering the thermal envelope. And in the little inset in the image on this slide, you can see that there's a bold red line around the walls and the ceiling and the floor. The thermal envelope is this shell within which we try and condition space. So I'm going to use that term a lot, thermal envelope or premium thermal envelope, to designate one that's really robust. Now, one of the big problems or challenges with building a premium thermal envelope today is in the appraisal and financing process. So appraisers will value a property or a building only on the basis of what they think other buyers will pay for it. And they have to do that. The lending institution needs to be able to protect their interest in the project. But home buyers who come in and look at a house that's already built can't look inside the walls to see what's there. And many of them don't care anyway. And so home values tend to appraise at what's called the least common denominator, basically the base standard thermal envelope. And that grossly underestimates and undervalues the construction of a premium thermal envelope, which in this country for an average size home can run into the six figures, depending on how far that goes. And since mortgages are based on mortgages for home loans are based on the appraisal, it means that homeowners who build a premium thermal envelope need to bring more of their own funding to the table. And what that has meant, unfortunately, is that only the wealthy have been able to build premium thermal envelopes, or those wealthy in assets. And maybe the implicit assumption from that is that only the wealthy can afford to build and live sustainably. That was concerning to us, and we wanted to test some of those assumptions. The end result is that most homes continue to be designed with little or no concern for solar or renewable energy on site, and very few thermal envelopes get significant upgrades. Again, this is because they're expensive and they're not valued. In other words, there's been little or no movement towards a sustainable future in terms of reducing the environmental impact of housing and buildings. So here's where our research began. In the US, consumers are rarely asked to pay the social cost of the environmental damage that comes from their transactions. A good example here is the carbon tax. When we buy gas and drive down the road, we've paid for the extraction and refining of the gas, but we're not asked to pay for the environmental damage from what comes out of our tailpipe. But there are a lot of folks who are interested in doing that, willing to do that if they know what the mechanism is, if they know the path to achieving that personal responsibility for our actions. So the graph on this slide shows the economic solution to this problem, and it adds the social cost to the supply curve. I think you can figure that out by reading the graph. And when we do that, it raises the price for the product, it reduces the level of consumption, and we do less damage to the environment for something that has what's called an environmental externality, damage that's outside of the transaction for the good or service. So we wanted to internalize the externality to figure out if it changed the dynamics or the calculus for when it makes sense for thermal envelope upgrades, when it makes sense from an economic payback perspective to put investments into the thermal envelope. So it's an economic or financial argument, but including by monetizing the environmental impact. Regarding the appraisal and lending piece, we wondered, could we build a case that would compel appraisers and financial institutions to value the investment at true cost? If so, that would remove a very important impediment and lead to expanded access and implementation. And for homeowners, home builders, and architects, could we build a case that convinced these groups to employ strategies that, while expensive initially, would lead to less environmental harm and reasonable long-term economic returns? While we had strong interest in pursuing these direct questions, we were also committed to keeping an open mind and to follow that into new areas if the data led us there, and in fact, it did. The first change or surprise came with solar. And if you've not seen the house that we've built, this is an image of it. And if you want to come visit, it's just on the west end of campus near the Discipleship Center. But the surprise here is that solar is even better than what was advertised. Buying energy by installing your own solar PV system costs less than buying electricity from your local utility. This varies by region, of course, depending on the number of sunny days, the latitude, the weather conditions. Also varies by local utility rates. But in the U.S., solar PV is economically viable for every state except Alaska and a small corner of Washington and Oregon. And right here in Harrisonburg, which is not great by other locations in the country, there are about two-thirds of areas, geographic space in the U.S. that are better than Harrisonburg for solar. But even here, installing solar returns a 10% annual average return over 30 years. That's better than putting your money in the stock market and with a lot less volatility, maybe a lot less heartburn. And that's without accounting for the environmental benefit. This is what was interesting. So solar PV sells itself on economic grounds without the environmental piece added in. And you would say, okay, why isn't it going up everywhere? Well, it's a complex model to understand. We can't do the math in our head. And so Eric is faced with the challenge now of talking with homeowners who want to do this and trying to lay this out in a way that's clear and understandable. We think this is a game changer, actually. But it got us thinking about the big picture of sustainable housing and fitting the various pieces together and looking at some trade-offs. So here's a big one. If on-site solar pays for itself and is in fact financially lucrative, how does that interact with thermal envelope decisions? So, for example, and I'm looking here at the option A box, is it better to build a more robust thermal envelope requiring a smaller solar array? Or option B, do we build a more basic envelope and simply add more solar capacity? So that raised questions about this embodied energy versus the operational energy trade-offs. Also, it was important for us to look what was happening at the margins as each of those systems was scaled up. Another interesting thing was it got us thinking about disaggregating the benefits of the premium solar envelope, because there are benefits to a PTE other than environmental, including greater comfort and potentially safety in conditions of extreme weather conditions. For analysis of the thermal envelope, we use a 30-year time period on structural elements because most mortgages are of that length, and we would expect the systems to last at least that long. And we use a cost of funds rate of 4.5%, which we think is a little bit conservative for today, may not apply down the road. Remember that the environmental reason for bolstering the thermal envelope is to reduce heating and cooling costs. That is, reduce the energy to power the heating, ventilation, and cooling systems. I'll call that HVAC. But look at this summary chart in which we've offered five hypothetical scenarios. And this is based on U.S. household averages of energy cost and the proportional share of that energy needed to power HVAC equipment. This is from the Department of Energy. The left column, which were our arbitrary levels of savings, shows various levels of savings on HVAC energy costs. The right column, which is our calculation, shows the corresponding maximum initial investment to receive a break-even economic return over 30 years. And that's with the environmental externality factored in. So let me talk through one of these examples. Take a look at the green highlighted bar. Even if it were possible to reduce HVAC costs by 50%, and that would be a mighty achievement indeed, the maximum investment to achieve that gain and simply break even over 30 years is $7,000. And $7,000 is a very small number up against thermal envelope upgrades, things like new wall systems, changing the wall systems, upgrades in windows and doors and insulation. In other words, $7,000 in upgrades will not come close to achieving 50% reduction in HVAC operational costs. Simple payback calculations, while failing to account for the opportunity cost and time value of money, are largely missing from the research in this field, which is absolutely amazing to us because these are investments that have long periods of time, and we're financing them on periods of 15 to 30 years. And it's this financial analysis that often turns the tables on choices to be made in thermal envelope upgrades. The bottom line is that most upgrades to the thermal envelope cannot be justified on either economic or environmental grounds. Economic because they do not offset enough operational energy costs to offer a reasonable return on investment. And environmental, because the increased embodied energy of most upgrades does not offset the theoretical operational energy savings. You catch all that? This was disappointing to us at first. This was the argument that we were hoping to make. Now, we have identified a very small number of targeted upgrades that we will recommend, but we're in the process of trying to test these in action to add confidence on those. And one of our objectives with our writing project, we're trying to put this into a book-length document, is that we would offer a design, maybe several models, of what we would call an ideal sustainable home, which would take into account this analysis and the economic and environmental trade-offs. So then, back to our question on the big picture between investments in thermal envelope upgrades or investments in solar PV. We did analysis and research on both of these variables, and this chart summarizes relative impact of scaling up each system. So when we think about scaling up the thermal envelope, we're talking about, in most cases, thicker wall systems, and that includes structural members and insulation. It means scaling up or upgraded windows and doors. Scaling up the solar PV system means more panels, modules, a little bit more racking, a little bit more in wiring and conduit, and a possible step up in inverter size, but maybe not. So let's look at the relative impact of scaling up the thermal envelope versus scaling up a solar PV system. On economic cost, scaling up the thermal envelope is high, and it often increases to scale, whereas on the PV, it's low, and it's mostly diminishing. On embodied energy impact, the thermal envelope is high, and it's often increasing, whereas the PV is low and mostly diminishing. As you scale up at the margins, operational energy impact is theoretical on the thermal envelope and vague, let's call it, whereas on the PV, it's direct and substantial. So when we put all that together and we think about the economic and environmental analysis, scaling up the thermal envelope is worse on all counts. Scaling up the PV is better on all counts. And this is surprising because the economic and environmental analyses agree on this. And we usually have trade-offs on these two. And it's not even close. Scaling up solar PV is better on both counts, and so we're back to the option B case. That's our win-win scenario. Unfortunately, we came to this realization too late for the case house, which I share with you now in the interest of disclosure and transparency and maybe not just a little bit of lament. And that verdict still assumes a theoretical efficacy of the thermal envelope and its upgrades reducing energy cost. Now, we didn't question the efficacy of that, but we were a little skeptical of the magnitude, and that's what we wanted to research. We wanted to find out, does this mean 20% savings, 30% savings, or what is it? And that led to yet another surprise. This was astonishing to us. So we started collecting household energy bills from the local region. We wanted to test these broad assumptions about the value of thermal envelope upgrades. Wouldn't you expect households living in premium thermal envelopes to use less energy per square foot? That assumption is taken as a certainty in the industry. We expected that assumption to hold, but wanted to know by how much. And we needed both energy and cost savings data to do economic analysis, both straight up and including the environmental externality. We understood that this metric that we were gathering, this energy data, would be rather broad and blunt because it wouldn't account for other factors that could affect energy use in the home, occupants and their energy habits, for example. Still, with enough samples to average and careful screening, we should observe the energy savings expected by a thermal, by premium thermal envelope. We didn't find that. This chart shows three common wall systems. Building codes in this area require ceiling insulation of R38. If you don't know what that means, that doesn't matter, but it's significant and it's already overkill from a cost-benefit perspective. So the real action is in the wall systems. 2x4 wood stud wall construction is the base standard across the country, and it has the lowest possible embodied energy of the samples in this case and in others that we see being used. We found that the cases of our database yielded a cost of 62 cents per square foot on energy use for the household. 2x6 wood stud wall is usually the first upgrade from 2x4. It has, of course, higher embodied energy than the base, and in our samples, it averaged 53 cents a square foot. One caveat here is that we don't feel like we have enough samples in this particular category to have confidence in this number. In fact, if any of you live in 2x6 wood stud houses and you're willing to share your energy data with us, we'd be glad to continue to build our database. The third wall system that we're comparing here is the top of the line. It's insulated concrete forms. We call that ICF for short. That has very high embodied energy impact, and we would expect energy costs to fall. But instead, 70 cents a square foot, higher than the 2x4 wood stud wall. And we feel like we have enough samples and have done enough careful screening to feel pretty confident about these numbers, at least to say that we don't think the ICF homes yield lower energy cost or use over time. The advantage of having a case study or a case project allowed us also to calculate the cost premium for the two upgrades in this example, and that's shown in the second column. So we didn't build with a 2x4 wall, but we calculated what that cost would have been, and we're calling that the baseline. And the 2x6 wall would have cost $2,000 to $5,000 more, about 6% of the cost of the structure. That range is depending on what insulation is used. We did build with ICF, which cost more than $17,000 more than the baseline, and that was done with the expectation of reducing operational energy needs. So as this data rolled in to us, I remember the incredulous looks on our faces as we asked the question, how can this be? This just doesn't make sense. At least the case house might be able to prove this correct. So here's information on the case house. I had mentioned that one of the challenges in the industry is testing with control groups or cases. Again, our case provided what we thought was maybe the best possible shot of an apples-to-apples comparison. We had been living in a home that was mostly code minimum in terms of its thermal envelope, and then we moved into this case house, which has the top of the line, premium thermal envelope. The location is the same, so we can't blame weather patterns. The same people moved with the same energy habits. The square footage on the new home, actually a little bit smaller, but the volume, the air volume, the conditioned volume space in the new house a little bit larger, but we had this big, robust thermal envelope to contain it, to reduce or minimize our energy loss. We had more windows in the new house, but the windows were top of the line. Triple pane, fiberglass frame, casement style, many of them were fixed. Very different from the windows in the home we had come from. Through 6 months, this is all we have in terms of comparative data, the premium thermal envelope is using 10% more energy. And we've cross-referenced this against average monthly temperatures. So it's not like this year is all that different from a weather standpoint. And we know that premium thermal envelope exacted a very heavy toll on the environment in terms of embodied energy. You'll notice one difference in the two houses is the operation of an ERV. This is an energy recovery ventilator. I'll say more about that in our discussion of explaining these surprises in our findings. We're compiling a list of possible explanations and doing additional research, but these three stand out. The first is diminishing marginal returns on thermal envelope elements. You know, where there's no insulation and you add that first inch, you get a tremendous value. But for every inch you add after the first, you get less benefit. And This graph on the slide shows the benefit of insulation by inch. And I drew a line in there at 3.5 inches, which is the stud cavity or the insulating cavity of a 2x4 wall. Now, building codes in most U.S. jurisdictions require a minimum insulation value in walls that can be achieved with a 2x4 structure. It happens to be R15. Standard windows and doors have an R value of 1, so 1/15th of the minimum wall R value. Now, you can get windows as high as R7, but you can pay 4 times more for those upgraded windows. So this sets up the condition of what we would call weak links, which are windows, doors, and anywhere where air might be infiltrating. So there's already this mismatch between wall sections at code minimum and these weak links. Much of the heat loss is passing through the weakest links and returns to thermal envelope upgrades weaken progressively with increasingly mismatched elements. So even though you're getting, you know, a better wall system, less loss from the wall system, you're getting less of the heat loss through that section of the wall. A third element is air infiltration. If we beef up the thermal envelope, but then allow, or in fact introduce by design, air infiltration, we further diminish the benefits of a thermal envelope upgrade. And a premium envelope will likely be so tight that you need to introduce mechanical ventilation, fresh air. This can be done through the ERV or its cousin, the heat recovery ventilator. So here's an interesting question, which I think gets at the focus of why ICF thermal envelopes are not showing the returns that we would expect. To what extent does the increased energy demand by mechanical ventilation offset reduced operational energy expected by the thermal envelope, by the premium thermal envelope? We also encountered big surprises about ERV installation specifications, the distribution of fresh air, and CO2 levels, which I'll get to here in a minute. But first, back to our maximum investments in thermal envelope upgrades. Where initially we found this result disappointing, it ended up being one of the strongest contributions of our work. And we think now, very good news indeed. It also goes against the ingrained assumptions in the building industry. So let me walk us through a little bit of the logic here. We did not find in our research evidence of thermal envelope upgrades reducing HVAC costs by significant margins. 15% would be amazing given what we found. So I highlighted that particular bar in this case. And if we knew that an upgrade could reduce energy costs by 15%, the most it would make sense to spend from an economic 30-year return perspective would be $2,100. And that buys almost nothing in a thermal envelope. That might buy 2 or 3 windows. And unless you can replace all of them with an upgrade, it's not worth doing. Meanwhile, most thermal envelope upgrades tax the environment more heavily from an embodied energy perspective. And given the fact that solar PV should be installed on every house anyway because it's an attractive economic benefit and ecological benefit, and the fact that code minimum requirements with quality construction already maximize the cost benefit to structure in terms of energy loss, and given that premium thermal envelopes are not valued by appraisers or lending institutions, meaning that they're expensive, given the fact that most thermal envelope upgrades worsen overall environmental impacts since the increased embodied energy does not offset operational energy savings. All of that leads to the conclusion that thermal envelope upgrades cannot be recommended on grounds of either economics or the environment. Here's why we think this is exciting news. The most sustainable home is the least expensive to build. It's a code minimum, code compliant thermal envelope, but with a process for ensuring quality construction and adding solar PV. And the appraisal and lending systems will likely value that package at constructed cost or perhaps even higher. All that should encourage rapid transition to sustainable housing, which can integrate transportation with EVs and potentially reduce energy and carbon footprint by 75%. There was a fourth area that led to some surprises, which I think I'll just briefly touch on in the interest of time. But we think that most houses today actually have a CO2 problem, not in terms of the CO2 they're emitting into the atmosphere, but the buildup of CO2 indoors due to the respiration of inhabitants. Molds, VOCs, and carbon monoxide have been the problems, and those are detailed in the literature, but not much has been talked about with CO2. Very recent research, academic research, has shown that there's cognitive impairment above levels of 1,000 parts per million. And most houses that we have tested have problems with that, particularly in rooms where people stay for long periods with doors closed, like bedrooms. So we're beginning to do a little bit more documentation here and expect to propose that for further research. Why these surprises? With regard to CO2, one of the other reasons is that monitoring equipment has just recently become affordable. You can get a meter, CO2 meter, for less than $100. Regarding the thermal envelope, the whole industry has struggled to measure whole systems' impact in action. There's also been a great deal of reliance on lab-based research on individual components rather than a whole systems review. The mismatched elements in the thermal envelope make it difficult to obtain system-wide performance metrics. And we found very little overall thermal performance analysis of fresh air induction or introduction. There's also not much on offsetting embodied energy impact against operational energy savings of thermal envelope elements. Most critical here, though, is that financial analysis, the tools of financial analysis, are either missing altogether in most cases or grossly simplified in others. And it's that very piece that often turns the choice on what is the best outcome. The financial analysis also applies to solar PV. We also found very little mention of the opportunity cost for funds or the cost of funds. And again, that has significant implications when looking at long amortization periods. There's also been some significant trends in the solar environment, including declining costs and a little bit more acceptance by local utilities to offer net metering, which is a critical part of it. We hope that our work contributes to the building industry. We believe that we can offer a clear path to sustainable housing, even transportation, that is not more costly, that need not compromise livability, that can potentially remove 75% of our carbon footprint. I think our case house here has demonstrated that already. It's doable. We wouldn't have needed to spend so much, but the idea of removing your carbon footprint from living, from operational energy through your living and your transport is possible. Our analysis also offers better solutions for existing buildings by retaining history, culture, and tradition by less invasive renovations, which should mean less debris to the landfill. And regarding appraisal and lending industries, we've already notched one win by convincing one lending institution and its appraisers to value solar PV in the appraisal process. And now we no longer want to make the argument to appraisers and lending institutions to value premium thermal envelope. Next steps, we plan to continue monitoring, research, and writing. Eventually, we hope to get a book published out of this. We also want to build a website with resources and calculators possibly hosted by the website for the Center for Sustainable Climate Solutions. That's the bulk of our study. It's much deeper than that and broader, but what I can offer in about 45 minutes. So we'll stop there and give you a chance to ask questions or offer comments. And let me also offer that Charles and Eric are here and willing to answer any questions you have.
So, Jim, maybe you said this, but for the solar panels, do you have externalities included in that? So, rare earth metal mining or things like that?
Yeah. So we looked at that in terms of the embodied energy. It's still a case that scaling. I mean, there are different kinds of elements. So we don't always have a fair comparison, but the volume of say rare earths used in scaling up a solar PV system is minimal compared to the embodied energy or environmental damage of scaling up a thermal envelope, particularly with regard to wall systems.
So because it's close, I'll ask and then I'll come your way. So I was interested in that, you know, that idea about that premium envelope there, the thermal envelope, and the fact that that was costing more. And I started to think about, are the people that are living in those houses, do they have more money to begin with? And are they then less sensitive to, I want to keep the temperature either higher or colder because of that? And if you've got people that are living at in less expensive housings and are maybe more cost sensitive, are they outside of their premium range? Is that, and I'm imagining that there are other, that we're using energy for other things in our homes besides the heating and cooling. But I think you were pointing out that that's what 75% of what, or it's a big percentage of what we're using. But those were two things that came up for me. The amount of the money that the people that are living in those houses that they have, and then their other consumption. Is that something that you took into consideration?
Yeah, we asked the same questions. And so you could look at it in two ways. One would be, so the premium thermal envelope, and particularly the ICF, has been pitched as the environmentally responsible choice. And so you could also say that those who took that step did it for environmental sustainability or sensitive reasons. And so you would expect maybe their usage in the home would be less than otherwise. But I think the one that convinced us, I mean, we already had this information before we moved into our new house, and we kept the thermostat at the same place. I mean, intentionally, we were intentional about not changing our habits because we wanted to do this side-by-side comparison. And that's what, just sort of put the final nail in that that choice.
That was basically my question. I was, and I think you clarified it, that it was all energy use, not just HVAC use when you measured the...
Our samples of regional homes.
Yeah,
that was all energy use. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So you didn't know whether they had a fireplace or not, or anything like that.
Correct. We did gather that information and tried to screen for that. Not in a precise way. We'd like to be able to do more with that and build our database, but we think we caught most of those pieces.
If you're looking at existing structures rather than new construction, do code minimums now perform better than some older existing structures that might maybe change the picture a little bit on envelope upgrades?
Yeah, although I would start with upgrades to renewable energy generation, and if you can, install solar. But it's the case, if there is no insulation, you will gain from at least some insulation in your walls, or windows, sometimes are worth an upgrade. But the first dollar ought to go towards solar.
I was just looking at the average numbers for HVAC cost and thinking that we didn't really fit into that number very well. And our number is just for heating. I think we might have some benefit just from envelope upgrades, perhaps versus solar, but that would be a hard calculation to make.
Yeah, I thought about those numbers, and so that's nationwide, and so that even includes densely populated apartments, say in urban areas, for example. It's also, you know, Florida and Maine, so you get the hot and the cold climates. So I think in our area here, we would expect a little higher numbers than those averages, because we're rural, because of the climate where we live.
Two questions. Is your solar calculations based on the tax breaks we get now or not?
Yes, it is.
Okay, so if those tax breaks are removed, where does it come out?
So we don't expect the tax breaks to be renewed, but it's 2022, and with the trend of declining cost of solar, if that continues, the tax break won't matter when it phases out.
And then secondly, there's a political component here, right? Particularly those who have vested interest in pushing the thermal, whatever you call it, the barrier.
The premium thermal envelope?
Yeah, so if I have a vested interest in pushing insulation, windows, et cetera, how do I fit in here?
That's a good question for our architect and builder. I think that's true. I mean, it's case with any business interest, right? It's easier to hear what helps you. I mean, we sort of came to this too. I mean, we were absolutely shocked to see this data on ICF homes in particular, and we had to reorient our thinking. Our businesses, people in business, and in these particular industries, willing to reconsider based on the evidence. I don't know.
You had a parenthetical comment about Tesla's potentially disruptive influence, solar tiles, for example. Would you suggest installing solar now or waiting a few years until Tesla solar tiles are widely available?
I'm glad you caught that. In fact, that one image was a Tesla home. I don't know if you recognize that. That was an interesting question for us. We talked about it on our project. I wish the solar shingles would have been available. They're coming out initially at very high cost. So I think it's still worth, you can count on a solar system to last at least 30 years, probably more than that. But I expect solar shingles to be available within 10 maybe at comparable rates or close to it. But where I think they're really going to be disruptive is with their home battery system and then integrating the battery of the vehicle as a backup. And when that happens, then we no longer are tied to the grid. And electric utilities may become less friendly to net metering policies if more people are doing it.
Jim, I have I don't know if it's a question or comment about, you mentioned there was lapses in lots of data that was missing. I'm really having a hard time struggling with how these premium thermal envelopes got so pushed without the data. I mean, you're talking about upfront $17,000 to put this in your home. There's no data that was going to be a payback. Is it just that the assumption is that tighter home, it's going to save energy, and nobody really measured it?
It's not just $17,000. That's just on the wall systems of a modest size home. I mean, you add to that upgraded windows and doors and all the various pieces that are required, and it's more like six figures. The benefits, the purported benefits, I think have been theoretical. I mean, lab tested, but not in real action. And this idea of introducing fresh air, and we have done this. We have an ERV that pulls in fresh air, but you've got to run the ERV. You've got to run the blower fan to get the air pushed to where it needs to be. You've got to condition the air that's coming in that's probably too hot or too cold. And the combined energy use of those three needs, does that offset the purported benefit of the thermal envelope. That's what we're trying to monitor right now. I've got some equipment on my house that's trying to calculate what these various energy draws are. Charles, do you have a response on that? I mean, he studied this. He did his master's degree in this area.
So I do have a vested interest in the thicker, more robust walls. It's what I specialize in. It's my differentiator and why we're still in business. If we didn't have that differentiator when the economy went down, I would say we would have gone out of business because my clients come to me for that knowledge. This research has turned what we know upside down. The data that's out there, I called National Home Builders Association chief economist and said, help me prove him wrong. The data is all based on simple payback. If we do this, we'll save 30%, and here's your payback. The payback that Jim does, I'm not smart enough to understand, but it seems like it's accurate. He's taking the true cost of that money, and if you invest it into, instead of spending it, in, the opportunity cost, instead of spending it on that wall, nobody in the construction industry does that. NAHB's response to why don't you do that was it's too complicated. So the National Home Builders Association is putting out all this data saying, do this extra stuff, and they're basing it on flawed data. So I really do think the research that we have, I'm still trying to poke holes in it and prove them wrong, because I still have a vested interest. But this is groundbreaking. This means that we can design affordable houses for anybody that have lower carbon footprint, lower ecological impacts. We can change the way that we live in this country by adding solar to every house that has a south-facing unshaded roof. And Jim even advocates for cutting down trees and planting them somewhere else if you don't have it unshaded. But unshaded south-facing roof is what we want. And we can design every house to have that. So I really do think that we've stumbled upon something that will make a big difference.
I think one of our challenges now is to know how to articulate that in a clear manner. Like even here, this was difficult to put this together in a way that I felt would be clear to a general audience. And I don't know if that was successful or not, but it's complicated. And so how do we piece this together in a way that will communicate well?
Well, that ties into my question. This is very interesting with indeed surprising results. I'm curious what your plans are for disseminating the information more broadly. So, do you have a timeline anticipated for when the book would be published and the website would be up and just thoughts about how you're going to get the information out there?
Well, we certainly don't want to put anything, out to print until we have at least a year's worth of data on the case home. We're also not ready from a writing standpoint. I don't know, we have about 60 or 70% of what we think we'll need, so we got to continue with that. Finding time. Can you give me some release time? neither one of the three of us has published a book, so we don't know what the process is, though we're getting some counsel from someone who's worked in the industry. We expect that to take a year or longer, probably longer. But we can begin by working on getting information up on a website. We've got a lot of calculators that are already designed and built, and we just need to get them operational on a website.
You might have touched on this, but I was just curious in terms of the premium thermal envelope, whether it sounded like most of the samples you collected were from this region. And so are you thinking of this as kind of a regional template, or are you trying to make it national? And if so, would you consider collecting samples from, I'm just wondering in very much colder climates in New England, if the thermal envelope would have more of an impact than in this region?
Yeah, we think our conclusions will scale nationwide with the exception of the, Alaska. We're specifically trying or intentionally not trying to apply it outside the US, so say to Canada or Europe, although a lot of the concepts should be similar, particularly in Europe that's at the same latitude and similar weather patterns as us. But we have looked at the different weather maps and zones that offer average temperatures and solar insulation. And we think what we've got is applicable to the lower 48 and Hawaii.
I just wanted to comment on the premium thermal envelope, and I kind of have an interest in that too. So this was a little bit disappointing for me. But I did want to clarify the premium thermal envelope that Jim used using insulated concrete forms. There are other types of wall systems that are less expensive and have much less embodied energy, such as a double stud wall with cellulose fill or a single stud wall with continuous foam. There are foams that have lower carbon footprints, such as polyiso or rock wool on the exterior. But I think the point still is that even with that lower footprint, the economics put into that little bit extra insulation still did not totally pay back compared to solar. So I think that's it.
Thank you very much, Jim. We always hope that our scholarship produces surprising findings, and these were surprising findings that were also significant and impactful. So I think you found the Holy Grail. We need to get it published. Yeah, that's great. Thank you all for being here. Next month's colloquium, third Wednesday, will be Holly Scott talking about her book on the 1960s social movements. So those of you whose hair is as gray or grayer than mine will want to come back and listen to research about yourselves. The rest of you might want to come back and listen to research about your older brothers or sisters or parents. So welcome back.